Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Richard York. He's Director and Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Sociology at the University of Oregon. His research focuses on environmental sociology, ecological economics, animal studies, and the sociology of science. He's published 3 books and dozens of articles. So, first off, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for all your work.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to talk to you today.
So, I would like to start by asking you the title of one of your articles. Do alternative energy sources displace fossil fuels?
Yes, so that article, what I find there is not very well. That's to say, I think we generally, there's a common assumption that we can solve our environmental problems through refinements in technology. And I think it's common to expect if we just expand the production of renewable energy or alternative energy sources, that will, by its nature, suppress fossil fuel use. And you know, it's not typically stated that explicitly, but it's clearly the implicit assumption is if I produce 1 extra kilowatt hour from wind power, that's one less I'll produce from coal or whatever. What I find in that research, so that's that article, I look at cross-national data over a 50-year period to see in nations when they increase their production of non-fossil fuel energy, what do we see happen with their fossil fuel use? And the interesting thing is what we see is it doesn't seem that fossil fuel use is suppressed very well by adding other energy sources. It's not that it's not at all, but it's nowhere near one for one. And that's also taking into account, when I say suppressed, it's not that we'd expect even an absolute decline, because most things, most energy use and population and GDP and so forth are growing in most nations over this time. So it's even not suppressed relative to what we'd expect given growth. So what that tends to suggest in a short summary way is that generally, the pattern across nations in the recent era is that new energy sources are added on top of existing energy sources, not in place of them.
So that would seem to undercut a lot of the rhetoric that we hear about climate change activism. I want to be clear, by which I'm not saying that, you know, climate change, the global warming isn't happening, it's not a disaster. I'm not saying any of that. But it seems that much of the argument is, oh gosh, the planet is heating up, so what we need to do is put in more wind and solar.
Yeah, so here's how I put it. Yeah, so I agree with you entirely that, you know, climate change is happening and it's a disaster. And we definitely need to do something about it. The question is what? And so a lot of what I am critical of is the assumption that the basic problem is a technological one. And I think that's where you're right, that I think a lot of activism means, oh, we just need to promote solar power and wind power. And it's not that I have anything against solar power and wind power, and I think they certainly can be helpful. I think the problem is we shouldn't see the problem as simply or primarily a technological one. We need to see it as more of a political, social, economic, cultural problem. And that's the kind of thing I study, then, is to see when you see technological changes, do you get what you expect? And the common answer is you don't. Technology doesn't work out the way it would superficially seem it should. And I think the reasons for that, once again, is there's much more going on there. So what this suggests is activists need to think more about how technologies are deployed rather than just what technologies do we have. And I think that's raises the issues of thinking about, you know, social power, who makes decisions, rather than just seeing that we have some engineering challenges before us.
Okay, I think that is one of the most important issues of our time, but this is not just of our time, but this is of the entire culture, what you're raising. I think that's hugely important. But I want to hold that off for a second, if you don't mind, and go back specifically to energy. And I do want to come back to this larger, incredibly important topic. But I'm wondering if we can talk for a moment. It's not just your research, but there's also this thing that a lot of people may not have heard of called Jevons Paradox.
Yeah.
And would you mind talking about that for a moment? Let's stay on the energy for a moment, and then I desperately want to jump to the bigger picture too.
Sure. So the Jevons Paradox is named for William Stanley Jevons, who was an economist in the 19th century. And he published this book called The Coal Question, in which he just made the observation that, ironically, as the efficiency of steam engines improved over the course of the 19th century, coal use continually increased, right? So it seems we would think if you improve efficiency, you would use less energy, but he notes the exact opposite. And if you think about those terms, of course, we look at the 19th century and say, well, that's obviously what's happened there is you didn't have many steam engines, and you had a huge increase of coal-powered technology. And in fact, what happens there is making steam engines more efficient in their use of coal makes them more desirable technologies. So more factories, businesses, industries invest in using them. So when we talk about the Jevons paradox, it refers to this kind of apparent counterintuitive effect where you see rising efficiency associated with rising energy use rather than declining energy use. And I think there's not a universal rule on that. Sometimes, you know, efficiency improvements do reducing energy use. But it's also very common to see it the other way. And on multiple scales, that can be relative to a factory or a nation state or the global economy. On all those scales, it's not uncommon to see rising efficiency associated with rising energy use. Go ahead.
So just to make a really tangible example,
yeah,
I run a factory, say,
yeah,
and I have, or here we go. You live in Oregon, I live in Northern California. So yeah, let's just say I've got a marijuana grow room, okay? And electricity costs X amount, and I've got X number of lights, and then I find a way to get cheaper electricity or cheaper lights, I have a choice. I can either pocket that money or I can expand my grow room.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And what tends to happen is we expand.
Especially within capitalism, which is based on expansion.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's exactly it. It's that in the context of capitalism, or more broadly, growth-dependent economies, improvements in efficiency get sucked up into expanding production rather than reducing resource use. And so just quick, I actually mentioned lights. Think of that example. You know, we often think candles are like, you know, better than light bulbs. When in one sense, a candle is extremely inefficient. It takes a lot. It's not as good at converting chemical energy into light. But, you know, you can only have so many candles. What happens when you make an electric light bulb? It's possible to light up everything everywhere, right? So we actually, with the development of electric light, we actually did make more efficient lighting, but that led us to make much more of it, right? So that's a common pattern, and I think that's how we tend to use technologies. I'll actually just give another related one to this, is think about improvements in what's often called labor efficiency or worker efficiency. That's if you look at factories, how much, you know, output you get per worker. Output per worker has increased hugely over the past several decades, right? That's what factories do. They increase their output and they don't necessarily take on more workers. One could think then that means if you're more labor efficient, we should all have to work less. Because you could think with the same amount of human labor as was used 50 years ago, we could now produce far more, or we could all work less and produce the same. So, but of course, the irony then, right, is over this time, actually, a lot of Americans work longer hours than they did 50 years ago, even though we're much more labor efficient. So we converted improvements into labor efficiency into much more production rather than us having more vacation time and shorter work days. So I think you see those kind of perversities happening, not just in energy use, but in, you know, in various sectors.
So you just stole my transition. My transition was going to be, so to be clear, we're not talking just about increases in energy usage. This is our transition back to what you were going to talk about earlier. We're talking about a larger social process. Is that the right word?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would call it kind of political economic process.
And so what... You've talked some about it, but can you get more explicit about that process and then also the implications of it and the social imperatives or political imperatives for it?
So, I mean, I think, as you already touched on, the issue of, you know, we live in this growth-focused economy. And I think to most of us, the world has been that way for all of our lives, right? This idea that we're supposed to consume vast amounts, you know, have cars, have houses, have electricity, at least those of us in affluent nations, that's presumed what life is about. And the economy is based entirely on growth, and it tends to be that politicians endlessly debate each other about who will spur more growth. And that's obviously a central feature of capitalism. I think we have to recognize how historically anomalous that is, right? You know, that consumerism is a thing that's been constructed very recently in human history. Through most of human history, people did not have per se the view that we do, that life is about the accumulation of more and more things. And I think that when you recognize the kind of emergence of this in the modern era, and it's particularly distinctive in capitalism, that, you know, we are not per se seeking to make the world a better place as a society. We're somewhat more perversely seeking just to make more in terms of dollars. That is so intimately tied with our environmental problems. And that's a lot of the theme I try and emphasize. We shouldn't simply be thinking about problems as technologically generated, but we should recognize the fundamental structure of our economy is such that we really can't solve environmental problems when we continue to push to use more and more, to have more and more, produce more and more. And so I think that's where we would see it more as a fundamental, you know, social, political, economic, cultural problem that we need to, you know, lead to social change then, not per se technological change.
I just yesterday finished reading a book by a novel by Charles Frazier. He's the guy who wrote Cold Mountain. Mm-hmm. This book was 13 Moons, and this is going to have a point. It's basically about it's a fictional autobiography of somebody who lived in the 19th century. And as he's getting very near to dying, he's very old, he reflects on the fact that through most of human experience, you would be born and then you would live and then individuals around you would die, but the land remained the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a big tree might fall and a few trees might replace it, but fundamentally the land's the same. And then he had this just line that is probably going to make me cry when I say it here, which is, most of us who live to an old age now, almost everything we loved has been destroyed. And that's this rapid change that we're seeing. I mean, where I live now, 20 years ago, the frogs were so loud outside you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night. And this year has been my silent spring for that. The frogs are gone. And so I think this is intimately related to what we're talking about with this accumulation too.
Yeah, no, and I think that's, you make a very good point about the change in whatever the landscape, in ecosystems. It is an extraordinarily rapid scale that we have come to take for granted, but really quite extraordinary, as you note, how much in such a short space of time such a large share of the planet has become under intensive management. that once again, through most of human history, that obviously was very, not that humans, of course, haven't always influenced their environment. They are part of their environment. But this extraordinarily intensive management has really taken over the globe in the space of, you know, a few decades or a couple centuries.
And, you know, we can either talk about Mumford or not, as you wish, but a question I keep asking, you know, you said we could have had more leisure, but we have more money and more things. And a question I ask all the time is, who's in charge? By which maybe I mean, what's in charge? So is that something you'd be interested in talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the issue, is so much of this comes down to power, right? It's who makes decisions, who gets their way. But that's one of the things, I think it's too common to frame environmental problems as if it's, you know, bad people, that most of us are just terrible people who are greedy and consume stuff, rather than saying we live in a larger world where it's, you know, there's kind of a context in which we act that leads to these kind of destructive behaviors. And that world was created intentionally by a few people for their benefit. And so the explicit issue here then is there's the, you know, economic elite, you know, the owners of factories and businesses have, it's no secret because they don't make a secret of it, have, as part of their effort to make profits, made huge efforts to construct a world of consumerism, to construct a world of growth. So it's not that all of a sudden most people woke up and said, oh, gee, I'd really like a shiny giant car. It's that was created as a quote unquote need. So if we're going to address those things, we have to recognize that most things aren't win-win. I think there's such a desire to always have these kind of positive win-win situations. There is a fundamental social conflict that some people benefit from the way things are and many people do not. That's the challenge then when you acknowledge that, because it makes it a little more complicated than trying to come up with something as simple as a new policy here or there. But rather really leading to a political struggle.
So I want to come back to the political struggle in a moment.
Okay. But
I want to return to your original question of, do alternative energy sources displace fossil fuels? And something I've been thinking about a lot, and I wrote this to you in an email last night, is that it seems to me that the massive subsidies that go to solar and wind, etc., these days are a really predictable result of capitalism having extracted the most cheap oil and moving toward other sources, and that instead of wind and solar being primarily a response to the crisis of a heating planet, they are instead simply new ways for capitalism, new frontiers for capitalism to exploit through subsidy, as they've gone through the cheap reserves of oil. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly why we don't see that substitution happening. I think you explained it very well. That it's just another form of exploitation to keep the system going. And so if we really wanted to scale back energy use and stop using fossil fuels, having solar cells could be very helpful. It's that's not what is going on. It's simply a way to continue expanding production and consumption and the generation of profits for a fairly small segment of humanity in the face of depletion of other resources. So I think you've really caught on to it well there, because I think that's the way to understand what's happening. Not that that's how things have to happen. It tends to be that's how it has been happening. And that we need to then recognize that larger context.
So if one more step before we get to what you talked about with political conflict, or what you mentioned with political conflict, which is, I mentioned Mumford a moment ago, and one of the things that really influenced me heavily is where Mumford talks about the magnificent bribe that is one way that, basically what he says very shortly is that the ancient despots would just rule by autocratic rule, and the more modern way that's much smarter is to extend at least some of the benefits to a significant portion of the population so that we buy in. And this is one reason that influenced me so heavily is because it seems one reason that so many of us don't resist is that we've been bought off by the access to ice cream 24/7.
I think that's exactly it. I mean, there's a long kind of scholarly tradition kind of looking at exactly that point, is how is it that we've all been made complacent, or many of us have been made complacent, is that, yeah, there is a sharing of material benefits to, a certain amount of people that makes it easy to kind of go along with the status quo. I mean, obviously that's strategically done. There's still a lot of people in the world who don't get much on the way of benefits at all, but it's kind of how, the ancient Rome, you keep people in the city of Rome happy more than you keep people in the Roman Empire happy. There is a certain element of that to keep the kind of middle class in affluent nations fairly happy so they go along with the way things are. I mean, I also think there are, of course, the other part of this is, all the other creatures of the world, the non-humans, don't even get a voice in this. So they tend to be, of course, completely left out.
Absolutely. So let's try to be as clear as we can. If there is a political conflict that implies multiple... So between whom would a... Okay, I'm going to back up a second. There are certainly political conflicts within capitalism between the paper industry and the technology industry as they jostle for resources and jostle for subsidies, etc. Let's just ignore those for a second. Yeah. A conflict that would lead to significant social change of the sort that both you and I are struggling for would be between whom and whom?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, actually, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement and the rest of that kind of thinking of the 1% and the 99% is a fairly good way to think about it. I mean, any kind of such summary, of course, will be crude and imperfect. But I think that is to say that if you look at the inequality in the world, it really is... we're at a point of extraordinary inequality where actually a very small percentage of humanity has most of the wealth, most of the resources. What we're talking about then is a struggle to better most people's lives. And those who are in charge are a very small group. So that's how I would tend to think of it, it's not 50% versus 50%. It's really almost everyone against a small group of people who've been taking advantage of the world for some time. And I think that's when you recognize that. I would hope that can help us also cut down on our other conflicts. I think too often we tend to have. Currently have this rise of these anti-immigrant sentiments or, blaming people from other countries or other races or other groups, and really see the solidarity that almost all of us are together on this, not to see divisions among us in the 99%, and really see that the key divide so much is with the few at the very top.
Okay, I don't disagree with you at all. And one of the difficulties is, I remember reading maybe 20 years ago this book called How the Irish Became White. Mm-hmm. And part of what really hit me with that was that the Irish were part of the underclass when they came to the U.S. in the 1840s, 1830s. And as a class, they had a choice of they could either try to consolidate working class solidarity with, for example, free blacks in the North. But it's really difficult because capitalism itself pits everyone against each other. And so if you have four children and two more died on the trip over and your children are starving to death, and you're white, and you have the opportunity to use that to your advantage over a black-skinned person, if your children are going to starve to death, man, you're going to take any... You've got this... You have this... Capitalism puts us into these making bad short-term decisions and as opposed to long-term class solidarity, better decisions.
I think that's entirely true. I mean, but it's capitalism. And there's, I mean, it's no secret that it's often been explicit efforts to, for example, to undermine unions. Is business owners try and create tension among workers so they don't organize. And one of those tactics is to promote racism or, you know, other kind of ways of dividing people. And that is a hard challenge to the rest of us for organizing, is to try and find connection with other people rather than those divisions. And that can be hard. I mean, no doubt that people come from different experiences, different lives. It's hard for us to connect with each other. But I do think that's what we need to do, is see beyond the immediate tensions and really see the common shared humanity that we have with other people. And that's particularly, I think, you know, just as a note, that's, even though that's a standard background thing, that's been very intensified lately with this kind of rise of Trumpism, of telling everyone, if you have a problem, blame someone else, you know, blame immigrants, blame poor people, blame, you know, as opposed to saying, well, it's really the billionaires you should blame. That's an old tactic. It's unfortunately been an effective tactic often, that people get distracted by, you know, these somewhat petty prejudices and can't focus on the bigger picture where we could really make most of us better off.
So so let's say we do start to build a movement of solidarity among 60% of the 99%, whatever. And we start to make... What should we do to... What would be some of the important first steps toward... toward if they put you in charge of the resistance, and what would be some of your strategic moves toward winning, whatever that means, this conflict with the billionaires?
Yeah. You ask, of course, the hardest question, right? It's how do we bring about social change we want to see? And I have to just be honest and say, I don't know. And the reason I say that in modest, and really is just kind of honest modesty, is people have been trying for a long time, very smart people have been trying for a long time to bring about changes like this and have not succeeded. Obviously, the way the world is, we have not brought about a society of greater inequality, of greater equality and greater justice. So I think that's one starting point, is this is obviously not something that's just a straightforward formula. And I don't think anyone truly knows. So what that means is it is a many pieces of struggle, and it reflects in many parts of life. I think the starting point, though, is to recognize the importance of collective action. So it is a collective identity, communication among people to have shared understanding of the world. And then recognizing that one of the central actions is going to have to be about economics. It's going to have to be about these issues of capitalism, of unequal wealth and ownership. But once again, I'm always left at that frustrated, because that's the question we always come down to, is what do you do? And I wish there was an easier answer to that.
Well,
do you know, Derek? Do you have a suggestion for me?
I was recently asked a question that I'm going to ask you in a moment. And the question that was asked of me was theoretical. Unfortunately, the person was not actually going to hand me money. But yeah. they said, if you got $20 million, if I gave you $20 million right now,
yeah,
what would you do with it? How would you? And honestly, what I said, and this is no surprise to anybody who knows my work, is I said I would organize a militant resistance movement aimed at attacks on industrial infrastructure, and which is not going to help the lifestyles of most humans, but it my loyalty is to the natural world. And I think about this in terms of if space aliens came down from outer space and they were changing climate, putting docks in every mother's breast milk and so on, what would we do? And so my answer was that, which was met with a more interesting discussion than one would expect. And so if somebody gave you $20 million right now and said, I want you to start building a, call it whatever you want, resistance movement, mass movement, whatever, what would be some of your first steps?
So I would actually start with what you say is I think there's a lot of value in direct action and confronting industrial dominance. And I have great admiration for the radical environmental activists who really take on a lot of personal risk to try and resist some of the worst excesses of capitalism. However, or maybe just a part of that is, for a long-term solution to these problems, we really do need wider social change. And I think a lot of those kind of immediate resistance is kind of a stopgap measure, right? Trying to stop the global engine of destruction from kind of rolling over all the forests and so forth. Longer term, we obviously need some kind of solution that gets society to the point where that's not going on, and that power is more evenly distributed, and we make somewhat better decisions. So in that sense, I think we do need to really take the environmental challenge is part of the broader social challenge of considering the well-being of workers, of all the other people, of the unemployed and the homeless. We need to have something that connects with all those people and brings them together. So what do you do? I don't know. So it's an interesting question. I don't know what would be exactly an immediate money spending thing, except I would think in terms of political social movements that bring together diverse factions of people to see some common connections. I think one of the challenges we face currently is, of course, that a lot of people who are most exploited by capitalism are workers, industrial workers, but they're also the ones who often go along with it most because they're understandably desperate to keep their jobs and livelihoods. I think those are the people we need to be thinking about and building connections with.
Yeah, I think, it seems to me that the question of jobs versus owls, or however that is so often put, is really just a modern version of the Irish becoming white, that they're being forced into a situation. I mean, this, both of us live in the West, and both of us know about how communities have been forced to, for example, log the hillsides in order to pay for schools. Yeah. And those are just classic double binds. No matter which decision you make, you're screwed. So it takes us back to, well, I want to go a different direction for a moment, which is for me, I'm really guided by something that a doctor friend of mine always says, which is, the first step toward proper treatment is accurate diagnosis. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to interview you, and I just love your work, is that, for example, you'll have 100,000 people or 200,000 people or 500,000 people marching saying, we need to stop this, we need to stop global warming. But if you ask them what their specific demands are, for subsidies for the oil and wind industries, which is an extraordinary coup on the part of the industries, and also is simply, as you point out, an incorrect diagnosis. And so, for what it's worth, for me, I think, I mean, we are not in a revolutionary phase. And if we, insofar as the United States is in a revolutionary phase, it's the wrong people and the wrong, I mean, they're the ones who are closer. And so for me, what I think we need to do is to do what you're doing and try desperately to keep throwing out our diagnoses to try to help people to be able to make, to figure out a plan. You can't have a plan until you know what the problem is. And so you articulating the problem is incredibly important.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, that's what, one of the things I struggle with, and I'd say it's common for kind of intellectuals, academics, of what can you do to make a difference? And it often feels frustrating and futile. And I should say, I really do have the most deep admiration for kind of the activists who really are out there, you know, taking the difficult actions that often put themselves at you know, and their freedom at risk. So I kind of often wonder, what is the role that is helpful as a scholar? And I think it's exactly as you said, we do need to understand the situation to know what to do. It's not just act, it's what kind of actions. Because I think there are a lot of people who recognize the severity of the problems we face, who want to take actions, but they do too easily fall into this, as you said, like, well, let's just build more solar panels and recycle, and, you know, drive my Subaru down to the protest where I hold the sign for an hour. I think it's we really do need to be, you know, asking the difficult, bigger questions about this kind of growth, power, expansion mentality that has taken over our world. And I think that's what I'd like to say I try and do, and I think a number of scholars try and do, is to be honest about that, to look at those and take on some of those difficult issues of actually, you know, state some of the challenges that we face. Because I don't think we'll do the right things if we don't understand those. And I think that's one of the problems with a lot of the big mainstream environmental organizations, is they often easily fall into the kind of expedient, immediate political solutions. And once again, I understand why they're put in that position, but don't want to take on the more radical questions of what are we trying to do here in the first place? And should we even be approaching things as how do you make ecotourism happen so you can have more profitability, so you can turn the environment into a marketable good?
Which, of course, is a huge problem right there.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to what you said about billionaires. And I have this problem myself that, on one hand, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, you know, just take, you know, 100 people and off with their heads and everything's fine. And another part of me recognizes that that is completely, as well as being sort of the precursor to the French Reign of Terror, is also simply not useful. Because what you're, neither you nor I are excusing billionaires at all. But you're not actually, the problem is not the individual billionaires, but the problem is the fact that there are billionaires. Is that correct?
Exactly. No, you say that extremely well. And that's it, is it's not about punishing those in power. It's not as if you had nice billionaires, the world would be okay. It's the structural incentives of the system is if you put someone, for example, if you put someone in the position of being a CEO of a company, the structural nature of that position is they're supposed to make profits for their shareholders, which puts them in a position of trying to expand production or consumption. So it's not so much the characteristics of those in those positions, it's the nature of having those positions. I think you said it very well. So yes, it's not a personal targeting, it's a asking, how do we structure things in the first place? And that's just like we discussed earlier of why often workers in factories go along with the system. They go along with the system because of their structural place in the system, not because of their you know, personal lack of values or concern. So that's why we need to think about the kind of the structure of the world. What positions do we put people in? And why is it that we now have a case where there's a few people who gain a lot from you know, burning more oil and expanding, logging and so forth. Why is it that we have a world where there's a few people in those positions where it makes sense from their narrow self-interested point of view to continue doing those things? And that would be the hope, is if we could have some greater democratization of the world, we might collectively make better decisions that are better for most people.
So I completely agree with what you're saying, and it seems that it leads to another problem, because it's really easy it's an easier rallying cry to say we're the 99% against the 1%, but we're actually, what we're fighting is not specifically and solely an individual, but the system itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, that's exactly, and that's why it's a challenge, because I think you don't want to fall into that. The personal animosity of it is, it's not, if you get rid of one tyrant, there's another tyrant that springs up, kind of problem, right? And that's why you need to think about the context of which this is happening. I also think, and I should just add to that, I think one of the, by saying that it's a small group of people in power make these decisions, that doesn't mean that there's not huge changes that all of us need to make. Because I think that's another part of it. It's not some simple, easy solution where if you could just, you know, get the billionaires to be decent people, you and I need to change our lifestyles. We are caught in this world of cars and airplanes and you know, big houses and sprawl. But the reason we drive cars and take planes is not because of our lack of personal concern or values. It's because of the situation we are in the world. So I think the point I'd make there is all of us need to change, but what kind of structures, what makes good options for change is about who's in power and who sets up the incentives in the first place. So I also just wanted to then, I don't think it's a free license to tell people that we're not individually, we don't individually have some responsibility to live different lives or make changes, but it is to recognize that most of us just do not have that much power to make a huge difference if we don't collectively confront those who really do make big decisions about, you know, how we make the world in the first place.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and there's sort of two questions I want to ask, and you can either do one, both, or neither. And one would be, are there things that you want to talk about on this general subject that I haven't given you the opportunity? And the other would be, can you tangibly tie the more recent discussion we've been having for the last half hour with the start of this about, do alternative energy sources displace fossil fuels? Can you tie that back? Can you tie them all together again? And I don't know if either of those are possible.
Okay, well, I'll think of that as a kind of tying things together. And so just, and this is a, you know, to give a brief summary, I'm very skeptical about framing environmental problems as principally technical in nature, and that we should be seeking engineering solutions and market-based solutions. I think we often think of the environmental challenge implicitly as equivalent to, say, the moon missions, right? Think about this. Can we put a person on the moon? It sets up a technical challenge. And I think that's how we think of a lot of ways people implicitly think of environmental problems like that. And that would make one optimistic, because we'd say, well, you know, we did put a person on the moon. Science is very effective at understanding the world. Engineers are bright people and very capable. And I'm actually quite confident if you set up a strictly technical problem and put resources into it, we've got smart scientists, smart engineers. Technical problems can be solved. The issue is, environmental problem is not like the moon mission. I would say it's more akin to, and actually related to, the issue of poverty. You know, addressing poverty is not a make some technical fix to this. It's a fundamental issue of, You know, how do people end up in different positions in life? Who has access to what? Who controls what? Who makes decisions? How do we distribute things? How do we produce things? It's a very diffuse and complicated problem. So that's why I would first say I think we should think of an environmental problem as more like poverty than the moon mission. And that really shifts how you try and address it. I would also then say that I think, you know, a fundamental part of the problem is the market system, and therefore I'm very skeptical about market-based solutions, you know, that we need to more see the solutions that we should be seeking are much more political, social, and then secondarily those kind of changes will affect how we make technological decisions and production decisions. I don't know. Do you find that as a reasonable overall summary?
Oh yeah, I honestly love it, and it's yeah, that was I think my favorite part of the interview. It's perfect. And unless you have anything else to say, I think that's a great note to end on. Anything else you want to say?
No, that does it. Thank you.
Well, I would like to thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Richard York. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.